Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. We have a lot to discuss today, but I'll be very brief in introducing the two segments that I'm sharing today because I think they're the most critical in relationship to what's happening right now in terms of this war that's going on Iran by Israel and with the United States assistance. For one thing, there is within the MAGA group, there is a fight on intervention versus non-intervention. We know that the United States is involved in this attack on Iran, this unprovoked attack on Iran during negotiations a day before or a couple of days before the talks were supposed to resume. They were supposed to resume on Sunday, and the attack happened on Friday. So there is a division, an internal division, and that's why I want to share this first segment with you, where a former Trump staffer warns about war with Iran. And it's a very insightful piece. I found it one of the most insightful because it's coming from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So let's listen to this former Trump staffer on Breaking Points.
We're very excited now to be joined by Dan Caldwell. He is a former Pentagon senior advisor, recently worked under Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth in the Trump administration, longtime foreign policy analyst and a United States Marine. I think the last one, most important title there for you. But Dan, one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is we've covered your story extensively here on the show, the story really of the ousting of you and really a target on both your back and others who were inside the administration, people who had spoken out vocally for restraint in U.S. foreign policy. And Dan, as somebody who literally worked, you know, for this most recent administration, perhaps you could give us some insight into some of the things that happened here. Let's start with D1, please, and put it up there on the screen. It does now appear, Dan, that many of the U.S. diplomatic efforts by Steve Witkoff and others served as cover for this Israeli surprise attack on Iran. Now, given your experience and some of your insight, you know, without getting into classified information, what's your assessment of what really went on inside here, now that you know all the principal players?
So I do think that at the end of the day, that diplomacy was and still is the primary goal. Yeah. Is that ultimately the president believes that the only way to solve this is primarily, when I say solve this, permanently solve this, is through a diplomatic effort. Because as a lot of people have pointed out, a military solution, even using all the power of America's bomber fleet, naval assets, and combined with Israelis, will not permanently dismantle the Iranian nuclear program.
Well, wait, can I zero in on that? Because you saw these war plans, all right? And you don't have to get into that, but you're somebody who actually sat there at the desk. So is that what you're saying, you know, given your knowledge, is that this is not something that can be solved by the United States of America?
Well, don't take it from me. Okay. I mean, the Israelis have said this as well, too. Now, there is a caveat to this, is you could militarily occupy Iran. Okay. You could do another regime change war, another long-term occupation of Iran. And that is the way that you would truly permanently dismantle Iran's nuclear program.
Okay.
Now, let's be honest. That would be incredibly costly. It would make Iraq and Afghanistan and what we've been doing in Syria and in other countries look like a cakewalk. Mm-hmm. Iran is a significantly larger country. It is a more militarized country with a much more advanced military. And a lot of people are focused on like their higher end conventional capabilities, but they also have a very strong militia force. They have an irregular militia force called the Bachi. Mm-hmm. And they are really truly a garrison state. And that would be an incredibly difficult occupation. So getting back to what President Trump was looking at doing is, I truly believe that a lot of this stuff about, oh, this was a cover, I have to say, I think is misinformation.
Interesting.
And I think that it was primarily, and there were others that disagreed in the administration, is that the president really wanted to prioritize a diplomatic option. Now, I'm not in the administration anymore. I don't know what has gone on the past couple of weeks for sure, but diplomacy was always the thing that he wanted to prioritize. And based on his remarks, I still think he wants to pursue a diplomatic outcome.
It's your belief that he was effectively double-crossed and betrayed by the Israelis here, because the reason that these strikes happened on, after the 60-day deadline that President Trump had implemented, that happened on day 61, something that he, by the way, highlighted and celebrated in the aftermath of these attacks. Very clearly, the timing of these was to blow up any possibility of a diplomatic solution, which is something the Israelis are not interested in. So you're telling me your belief is that President Trump was effectively betrayed, his diplomatic negotiations undercut by the Israelis? Or do you think that he bought into this, what I think is preposterous, you can give your opinion, expert opinion on it, preposterous belief that somehow going to war with Iran was going to make it easier to effectuate some sort of a peaceful diplomatic solution?
So, Crystal, this is a cop-out. A lot of my assumptions over the last week have been blown up. And I can't answer that question with absolute certainty. What I can tell you from my experience inside the administration and what I know of the people in the administration is that diplomacy was what they wanted to pursue. So you had guys like Steve Witkoff. You had people like Michael Anton. You had a lot of folks across the administration that were putting a lot of effort and trying to come up with ideas on how to make diplomacy work. Was it always perfect? Were they always doing the right thing? These are always incredibly difficult things to pull off. I think that if we look back, there are maybe things that could be done better. And I think to your point is going forward, yes, I think you have to admit is that in the short term, diplomacy is going to be incredibly difficult. It's going to take a lot of things to come back from what has happened over the last few days.
Right. So this is what I want to get to then, because you named some of the pro-diplomatic factions. You don't have to get into names if you don't want to, but describe for us what the other faction inside perhaps the administration and in Washington appears to be that obviously is now backing Donald Trump behind this action and really is both loving, celebrating the Israeli military campaign and actively working to put the United States into this conflict. What does that faction look like and where are they located?
Well, within the administration, one observation I've had is, and I didn't work in the first administration. I worked a lot with them on the outside, mainly on reforming the VA, and then towards the end on ending endless wars. What I saw in the first administration is you had most of the people in the administration, particularly on the national security side, dislike the president and were oftentimes working against him. This time you don't have that. Is you have a lot of truly smart and talented people across the interagency. A lot of great people at the Pentagon, especially on Birch Colby's policy team. You have great service secretaries. I think the Deputy Secretary Steve Feinberg is doing a great job. And at the State Department, similarly, you have people like Michael Anton, and you have a lot of great people in the Vice President's office at ODNI and at the NSC. And they all largely, they have disagreements over the issues, but their attitude is this. Is they have their views, they are going to make recommendations to the president based on their analysis of intelligence on the DoD side of the trade-offs to accomplish certain military options, and they're going to make those recommendations. They're going to run them up the chain. And from there, the president and the principals are going to debate and decide. Now, within the administration, I think that most of the administration, the political appointees, understand that there's a lot of danger with a war in Iran. Not everyone, but most folks do. I think there are a lot of folks in the uniform military that actually think that a war with Iran would be disastrous. But there are folks that still are under this delusion that all we have to do is send a few B-2 bombers in and drop a couple massive ordnance penetrators on Fordo, and everything will be fine. And there's a lot of people outside the administration in the think tank community, in Congress, in the advocacy space, in the media, that are still bought into this idea that this is largely a risk-free proposition. And let me tell you, if the United States gets directly involved, there's a risk that it could be one of the biggest national security catastrophes we've seen over the last 20, 30 years.
Let's stick with that. So let's put D2, guys, please, up on the screen. Here we have a recent report, as you just mentioned, somebody, Elbridge Colby, somebody who I consider a friend and a very, very intelligent person. The headline here is Pentagon is split over Trump's Israel policy. But specifically, Dan, what they are talking about is a war inside of the administration here between the CENTCOM commander, General Michael Carilla, and Elbridge Colby, who is the, what is he, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy.
Yes.
Who, I mean, has the audacity to suggest, hey, we need to be careful with our military resources here. A war with Iran or offensive military action against Iran in conjunction with Israel would significantly deplete our stocks, and it could make us very unprepared for a conflict that actually matters. Describe the contours of this, General CENTCOM, the CENTCOM commander, General Carilla, who is both CENTCOM is under his environment. He is scheduled, I think, to, you know, his term be over soon, but he is the top military commander here, obviously has the ears of the Secretary of Defense and the president in this theater. What are his views here of the conflict?
Well, first of all, I just want to say regarding Bridge and his team, you know, my friends, Mike Dimino and others, they're doing their jobs. Their jobs is to challenge what the combatant commanders want to do. It is their job, since the combatant commanders are very focused on the regions they control. Their AORs is what they're called. Their job is to look at the global picture and assess the trade-offs to support what various combatant commanders want to do. So we're in an environment where the United States' military resources are constrained. We've had 20 years of plus of wars in the Middle East. We have emptied many of our magazines of ammunition and our arsenals to support Ukraine. We have an environment where our resources are not limitless, so trade-offs are real. So every asset we move into CENTCOM comes at the expense of another combatant command, like the Indo-Pacific, where we have a real threat, a real challenge in China. We trade off against things we're trying to do in the Western Hemisphere. I think one thing this administration deserves a lot of credit for is more of a Western Hemispheric focus. So Bridge is doing what he's supposed to do. And I'll also say this, knowing Bridge and Mike and the rest of the team there, is they're going to challenge, which is healthy and good. They're going to make a recommendation, but at the end of the day, when the Secretary of Defense and the President makes a decision, they're going to turn around and follow it and ensure it's implemented properly. Now, in regards to General Carilla, look, I mean, I think it's been reported, and I, you know, based on my experience with him, is that he takes a fundamentally different view of the importance of the Middle East than a lot of other people in the administration. And he also, I think, believes that a military campaign against Iran will not be as costly as others. So that's his view. And I think there are a lot of folks that want to see some type of military action occur before he retires as a result of that. So he retires, I believe, in the middle of July. And I don't think it's a coincidence you see a lot of the pressure ramping up to do something prior to his retirement.
Got it.
So just back in March, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard testified that the intelligence community continues to assess Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. Let's go ahead and take a listen, just a little flashback to her testimony to this regard.
The IC continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has not authorized the nuclear weapons program that he suspended in 2003. The IC continues to monitor closely if Tehran decides to reauthorize its nuclear weapons program.
What is your understanding of the current situation? Because obviously, I mean, we've covered all the comments now about how the real goal for Bibi Netanyahu and others who are supportive of this direction and policy, what their real goal is here is regime change. But the nuclear program is being used as the pretext and justification for these strikes. So what can you tell us about Iranian nuclear development?
So I obviously can't get into specific intelligence and what was discussed and what I saw or didn't see. But my understanding was that that assessment was correct and was largely agreed to across the intelligence community, whether it's the CIA, military intelligence community, what the State Department have. And the State Department actually has a very good intelligence branch, one of the best. Actually, they've been more right than the rest of the IC. It's called INR. But that has been the consensus for a while now. And one of the reasons actually that is the consensus is based on Iranian behavior is, I think this often gets overlooked, but I believe it was Khomeini, before he died, had a fatwa against developing a nuclear weapon, and that hasn't been repealed.
Yes, mm-hmm.
that was an indicator that a lot of people were watching that if they repealed that, like, okay, now they're going to sprint towards a bomb. Mm. And I'd also know too is that it's not a matter of they can just snap their fingers and in a day they could have a bomb. There's still a breakout time and window, and then it takes more time to actually weaponize this. But again, from what I know, and I've been out of loop now for, you know, close to 2 months, is that that assessment still stands.
Well, one thing I look at, Dan, is even in Beebe's announcement of the war, the shortest timeline he gives for a breakout is a few months. This is not a, you know, a couple day thing. That basically aligns with
what we've been hearing since the 90s.
Yeah, of course. We've been hearing that. Even if that's BS, he doesn't even say they're days away from a nuclear weapon. He's like, we're a few months away from a nuclear weapon. It's like, well, okay, so we had a deal tomorrow to have a talk. We can't do that. You know, it's like one of those where it's just extraordinary. And really what I want to get at with you, Dan, is within this administration at this point, you know, if they go forward with this, and of course it'll look, they'll try to minimize it. You said, we just got to do a B2. What does it look like from there? You know, the B2, that's step one. So now what? You know, if we see the Straits of Hormuz get closed and all of this, what, how many resources of the United States would it take, even from that point of a so-called limited intervention?
Well, I think we need to start with what is the war right now? And as we sit here today, and there's a lot of things changing, and it could change, you know, very rapidly in the next minutes or hours. But right now, essentially, the war is a race. It is a race between Iran and Israel to see who can destroy the other side's critical military equipment the fastest and exhaust the other side's supply of critical munitions. Mm-hmm. So for Israel, that is Iran's ballistic missiles, but also their ballistic missile launchers. That's really actually probably more important than missiles themselves. And that's why the Israeli Air Force, it appears, has really started to focus on those in the last days. For the Iranians, they are trying to exhaust the supply of the United States' THAAD batteries they have there. Mm-hmm. And then Israel's very good integrated missile defense. They're trying to exhaust the supply of their missile interceptors, mm-hmm. while simultaneously trying to outlast Israel's supply of precision munitions, particularly their standoff munitions. So in terms of that race, who has the advantage right now? It's hard to say. It looks like the Israelis did a really spectacular set of strikes the first day. They destroyed a lot of the Iranians' command. They did hit some key sites, but Israel doesn't have the size or doesn't have enough planes and the ability to basically attack the Iranian military on a scale that it would destroy their offensive capability in one day. So Iran, as we sit here today, still has a lot of offensive capability. On the other hand, Iran has not launched as many missiles as we thought they were. But more Iranian missiles seem to be breaking through as the barrages continue on. So
what does that indicate to you?
That indicates to me that Israel and the United States are either rationing their interceptors, mm-hmm. knowing they have a limited supply, or the Iranians are learning how to launch their missiles in a way that they can break through defenses. Now, getting back to your question of, like, what does this mean for the United States? Well, again, the United States is in a resource-constrained environment. Our ability to fight a prolonged war against the Iranians is very limited and would come at very high trade-offs. So what would it look like, say, if there was an authorization to use the B-2s to strike Fordo? Well, I think that from there, Iran would feel like the United States is now directly engaged in the war, not just indirectly through defensive. And they would feel like now we have to strike American forces in the region. And this is where the casualty figures come from. And this is where I think some people get dishonest, because they say, oh, nobody's talking about boots on the ground. Well, we have 40,000 troops spread across the Middle East, all of whom are in striking range of Iranian ballistic missiles. And I have to say, many of them are on bases that don't have the same layered defenses that most Israeli cities have. So you could have a situation where the Iranians are launching mass drone, mass missile attacks on these bases and can inflict heavy casualties on the United States. Now, what happens from there? The people who've been saying, you know, oh, we just got to let Israel do what they want to do, and they don't need our help, to then now a couple days later is like, the America needs to get involved and we need to have B-2 strikes on Fordo. Those same people are going to call for escalation. If the United States escalates, there's going to be more attacks. They could start attacking our Gulf Arab partners and allies. Mm. And then from there, you have the Straits of Hormuz potentially closed. You have attacks on energy infrastructure. Energy prices spike.
Straits of Hormuz is what, 30% of energy?
I believe it's 20, 30%.
But it's a huge portion of China, actually. Now, so then they might need to get involved.
Yes, they may look at the need. They may look at what's happening in the Gulf and say, okay, now's the time to make a move against Taiwan. I'm a little less confident in that, but that is a possibility. So you'll have massive energy spikes here in the United States, which could upset the progress that President Trump has made on reducing inflation. You'll have thousands, potentially thousands of dead American soldiers, diplomats, and other civilians. And let's not forget, too, you will have a lot of dead Arabs, dead Iranians, and yes, dead Israelis. Mm. You know, it is Israeli civilians, Iranian civilians that are paying most of the price for this war right now. We can't forget it. You know, I was reading coming in here today, it looks like that many of the casualties last night from the Iranian nuclear strike were Ukrainians, that they were probably Ukrainian refugees, Ukrainian Jews fleeing the war in Ukraine. And I don't know that for sure,
but these are the strikes in Tel Aviv.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, you know, those are the people paying the price in that. And it really upsets me that people are minimizing this on both sides and ignoring that. And this is where it could head. It's just not a video game. We don't have a magic power where it's just a matter of a few B-2 strikes and a few cruise missiles and this problem is solved. There is real risk that this could escalate into something much, much worse.
Well, and Dan, let me ask you one more question on that. I mean, we saw, you know, our intervention in Libya, which ends up in that country being a failed state. Let's say that Bibi Netanyahu and others get their wish and this regime in Iran effectively collapses. You know, what is the fallout? What does it look like if you have this giant, incredibly significant country as effectively a failed state?
Well, my friend Sohrab Ahmari actually wrote a...
We're going to have him on the show on Thursday.
Really great Twitter post about this. And Sohrab, I think, is really interesting because he used to be a regime change advocate. And he's reassessed his views. And he walked through, I think, very effectively of what that would mean is... You know, it mean that the United States would have to get more involved in the Middle East when we're trying to do less and empower allies to do more, including Israel alongside the Gulf Arabs. It would mean probably higher energy prices for at least a short term before global markets could adjust. And, you know, you could have an actual true nuclear threat here because you could have bad actors outside of the Iranian regime get a hold of this nuclear material and build something like a dirty bomb.
Yep.
And so, and they, Iran has other WMDs. They likely have chemical weapons that could fall in the wrong hands. So it's a huge threat. The Iranian regime is awful, one of the worst on the planet. But they are still a regime that has shown that they have not provided these weapons to some of the bad proxies in the region yet. Mm-hmm. That could change if the war drags on. And they have not done certain things that you would expect a totally irrational regime to do.
Correct.
And we just simply don't know what would replace this regime. And that is one of the big things, the problems with regime change.
One last question for you. You know, by all accounts, it seems the Iranians were engaged in diplomatic negotiations with the Trump administration in good faith. Of course, they had previously engaged with the Obama administration in good faith and were able to secure a deal that the first Trump administration got out of and the Biden administration declined to get back into. You know, it seems to me like if you're, you know, as a layman here looking at the Iranian calculation, this has created additional incentives for them to accelerate towards acquiring nuclear weapons. I mean, as an expert, you know, is that your assessment, too, of the sort of calculus that has been created, not just with regard to what we did with Iran, you know, basically lying about diplomatic negotiations to create the conditions for an Israeli surprise attack, but with regards to Libya, with regard to other countries around the world, even Ukraine? You know, is that the sort of calculus that our foreign policy has created for countries?
Well, I'm far from an expert on this. I'm just have the privilege of knowing a lot of really smart people whose ideas I can steal. I think, yes, there is an incentive now for the Iranians to actually break out and pursue a nuclear weapon before. And Crystal, you kind of alluded to this earlier. I think that for the Iranians, you know, they want to have the appearance that they could break out. They want to preserve some type of capability, in large part because of what happened in Libya, because of what happened in Iraq, and recently Syria as well, too.
Yeah.
It hasn't happened in North Korea. But for them, the nuclear weapon threat is more of a bargaining chip for things like sanctions relief, mm-hmm. better integration in the region. And really, the biggest guarantors of national survival are things like their missile program, which for them is very important because of their experience in the Iran-Iraq war, where they were really brutalized by Saddam's Scud missiles, his Tupolev bombers. So that's more important for their regime and national survival than a theoretical nuclear weapon. But look, if the United States is perceived as not being able to negotiate in good faith along with the Europeans, if mm-hmm. there's a belief that other actors in the region are going to undermine it, then they just might make the decision like, okay, we're going to be the Middle East, North Korea. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, they already are. We're going to, you know, break out and basically become a massive hermit kingdom. And that's the only way we're going to be able to survive as a nation.
Yeah. And that's a terrifying lesson because that actually did work for North Korea. And
They're
still there. And every time I've talked with multiple people on the negotiating team with the DPRK, every single time we told them to denuclearize, they're like, yeah, how'd that work out for Gaddafi? They know. They're not stupid.
Well, it's funny. It's not a coincidence that in the middle of the negotiations where President Trump was making progress, and he deserves a lot of credit for taking the steps he did. Mm. It's not a coincidence John Bolton came out and started talking about Libya.
Yeah.
That was a deliberate attempt to undermine his negotiation. I will say, this time I think among his political appointees, you don't have people like that would go and ultimately try and undermine negotiation if it reaches a point at
that
point.
That's if we can have a negotiation.
Yeah, but yes.
If you do.
Yeah.
But again, I have to acknowledge that it is going to be tough to get negotiations back on track. But there is still a pathway for that. It's going to take more time. And the biggest thing the administration is going to have to show on that is patience.
Yes, very well said. Dan, really appreciate you, man.
Dan, thank you so much. We appreciate you talking to us.
Very much so. All right, we're going to go to the next part. Hey, if you like that video, hit the like button.
So that was an interview conducted with a former Trump staffer. Of course, what I'm trying to provide to you is information from the horse's mouth. It's not an endorsement of all what he said, but obviously there's a lot of risk in the U.S. being involved. Of course, none of us want this, but he just really lays out most clearly what are the risks involved in taking such steps, which they've already taken some smaller steps in providing, of course, material and intelligence and all that to Israel. And right now, Israel is like AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, is sending, you know, messages to everybody to try to ratchet up this thing, to get the United States embroiled in this disastrous war, and because they had underestimated also what the response is going to be, and that's what the next segment is about that I'm about to play, and this is relating to Iran hitting Israel harder than expected, and how they hit Haifa and Tel Aviv. So let's listen to that segment.
Israel, as Iran launched overnight another major missile salvo. Military experts are reporting that over 100 ballistic missiles were launched at Israel. The overall effect, of course, it's hard to verify, but in terms of the video imagery and the reports coming out from independent media as well as Western mainstream media, the damage is becoming more widespread, despite the fact that Iran is likely launching fewer missiles now than they were in their initial opening of Operation True Promise 3. The impacts are becoming harder and they're becoming more accurate. We saw this in Haifa. In Haifa, there have been videos showing burning all across this city. In particular, the oil refineries and power stations located there. Imagery and videos have shown that blackouts have occurred, and Israel is reporting this as well. Now, Israel, of course, sends all of its settlers into a frenzy with sirens warning them to run to bomb shelters when missiles come overhead. We saw this with Yemen, Hezbollah, etc. earlier phases of this war. Now, with Iran, this is happening with increased frequency. But Iran has warned all settlers to leave Israel. Why? Because Iran knows where these bomb shelters are, and we have seen imagery from Israel itself showing that bomb shelters have indeed also been hit. So Iran has increased its escalation on Israel in large part because Israel continues to target residential buildings, civilian areas, even hospitals in Iran. Iran is reporting 224 civilians have been killed. Alone in Israel overnight, at least 9 Israelis have been killed by Iran's missile barrage. Now, it's not just Haifa that was hit, because Haifa has been getting the brunt of the reports and imagery because of the importance of hitting the power station. But Tel Aviv continues to burn. Residential buildings have been hit, in large part because air defense systems are located in and around these residential buildings. We also saw that Ben-Gurion Airport, a plume of smoke has arisen there, likely because Iran has hit there with ballistic missiles. And not only this, but the Negev Desert, which hosts the Dimona nuclear facility, as well as the Nevadim Air Base, has come under heavy fire. Israel is trying to censor the imagery and video coming out from there, but we have seen that Israeli air defense systems are becoming visibly exhausted, with in the Nevadim Air Base area, air defense systems being activated and failing to hit their targets, leading to a situation where actually these air defense systems hit back at themselves, fall to their ultimate doom, and become destroyed after missing their intended target. Iran is also targeting Patriot missile batteries. We have seen these be destroyed in this overnight salvo. And many military experts are saying that this is the most devastation that Israel has ever faced. The panic now is widespread. We saw Netanyahu go onto Fox News, and what did he say? Well, he said that not only is Iran trying to kill Donald Trump, but that Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu is the U.S.'s junior partner. And he has emphasized over and over again that the United States needs to enter this war on the side of Israel to a fuller extent.
You just said Iran tried to assassinate President Trump twice. Do you have intel that the assassination attempts on President Trump were directly from Iran?
Through proxies, yes. Through their intel, yes, they want to kill him. Look, he's enemy number one. He's a decisive leader. He never took the path that others took to try to bargain with him in a way that is weak, giving them basically a pathway to enrich uranium, which means a pathway to the bomb, padding it with billions and billions of dollars. He took up this fake agreement and basically tore it up. He killed Qasem Soleimani. He said, made it very clear, including now, you cannot have a nuclear weapon, which means you cannot enrich. He's been very forceful. So for them, he's enemy number one.
Yeah.
Look, they also tried to kill me, but I'm his junior partner.
When did
they
you
understand that President Trump is a great threat to Iran's plans to weaponize nuclear weapons and use them?
When did you tell President Trump you were going to launch these strikes?
Look, I've been in constant contact with President Trump. We've known each other for many years. And obviously, we informed our American friends and President Trump, our great friend, ahead of time. We did. He knew about it, of course.
I mean, there are reports that President Trump kind of helped you achieve your strategic surprise by publicly urging you not to attack when he already knew you had decided to do it. So you were closely coordinating with the U.S. throughout this process.
Look, we're fully coordinated, but understand that America, under President Trump, will make the decisions that are best for America. That's the way it is. He understands that I, as the Prime Minister of Israel, the one and only Jewish state, must make the decisions that are important for the survival of my country, and he will do what is best for America.
So the desperation is becoming more profound. We see the United States sending its tankers and its aircraft to the region. There have been many reports for those following the surveillance imagery of the activity of these flights. They are heading from the United States toward the Middle East, likely to, in the event that the United States escalates and decides to join, that they are ready to do so. So this is the situation. Now, many reports have also indicated that Israel does not have the munitions capability to take out not only Iran's nuclear facilities, but they have no ability to take out where their missile stockpiles are located, because they're located deep in the mountains, many of them underground. And only the Moab bunker buster bombs, which the United States, I don't know if you remember, back during the first Trump administration, tested these in Afghanistan. Only these bombs can potentially break through Iran's hidden stockpiles. So the situation for Israel is becoming more dire. The imagery, the idea that Israel is invincible, for example, that has been burst asunder. Israelis are not safe. They are being warned to leave. And the videos of Haifa, the videos of Tel Aviv, the imagery of Iran's missiles hitting Israel hard, and each day they be launched, at least 100 of them, is showing that Iran's capabilities are indeed intact and quite strong. Now, the former IRGC general, I believe his name is Razem, he said that Iran hasn't even dug into its newest stockpiles of hypersonic missiles. Some are saying that hypersonic missiles have not been used at all. So Iran is claiming that they have not even used their newest weapons, which will cause even more damage and are even more difficult to take out from the air. So it's quite obvious that if the scenes in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, B'nai Brek, and a lot of these Israeli cities and areas surrounding Tel Aviv is any indication, central Israel as well in the Negev Desert, if they're any indication, it shows that Israel's air defense systems are exhausted, and that even Donald Trump has reported numerous times, and this is an interesting development. On the one hand, he said that the United States could become more directly involved in this conflict, and on the other hand, he has said that Israel and Iran will have to come to a deal. How I read that is that he is saying that, one, both the situation is dire on both sides. Of course, he will never claim it's just the Israeli side that is suffering the most from this, but that a deal will have to be made, which shows that perhaps the United States does not have a huge appetite in entering. And there's a huge debate about whether this is going to happen. Some believe the United States is already in on this war. I happen to agree with that. We know that the Trump administration knew all about this, that they were committing head fake after head fake to prepare for Israel's launch. They sent additional weapons. We know that the tankers are in full effect and leaving for the Middle East. We also know that Israel itself cannot survive without U.S. help throughout any part of any fight that Israel is engaged in, whether it's Gaza, the genocide, whether it is what happened happening in Lebanon, Syria, etc. We can go on and on. So the situation is that the United States is already involved, and we have to understand it from this perspective. Now, we also have to note that the Trump administration has a very hard decision to make right now. The Trump administration has to decide whether it is going to protect Israel and defend Israel to the fullest extent, knowing that eventually Israel's air defense systems will become so exhausted that it will be defenseless. And this is likely going to be unacceptable to the United States. But as I've said, if the United States enters the war to a more fuller extent, the United States will have to risk suffering potential catastrophic losses, especially on the PR standpoint, whether it's a U.S. naval destroyer being hit by one of Iran's newer hypersonic missiles that are incapable of being downed by air defense systems, or whether it is U.S. aircraft downed from the air, like the F-35s have been downed from Iran up until this point on the Israeli side. So these are the risks that the United States has to consider as it ponders whether it should wage a full-scale intervention against Iran. Now, in another report, it was noted that Donald Trump has rejected the assassination plot and plan from Israel regarding Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So the reports are that Israel has a definite plot and aim to kill the Ayatollah. And this is an assassination attempt, of course, to get rid of the head of the snake, as Israel would see it, of Iran's leadership, and really commit to and succeed in the project of regime change. Donald Trump is said to have rejected this attempt. Now, this, I think, is, of course, fake news in many respects. If Israel has a plot to assassinate major leadership like it already has in the IRGC, for example, then the United States is not only going to be involved, but the United States is, of course, going to give the green light and the okay for that. Now, this could very well be a head fake, like this whole operation, this whole aggressive strike on Iran has been. The United States, as reports have indicated in Israeli media, the United States was not only using negotiations with Iran to lull Iran to sleep, as they claim, in order for Israel to prepare for this attack, but that in the conversation that the Trump administration had with Netanyahu, for example, that there were reports that as Trump was claiming he rejected Israel's desire to attack Iran and said, you can't do this right now, in effect, the United States was secretly greenlighting this latest attack and using the media to promote plausible deniability and get Iran to relax and not be able to respond to this strike that eventually occurred on, I believe it was June 11th. So we are now in day four of this war, and we are now able to evaluate, well, what has been the impact of this? And the impact, of course, is immense, from the fact that Israel's portrayal and imagery and identity as an invincible force in West Asia, of course, fully backed by the United States, that has been fully penetrated, fully demolished, and fully destroyed at this point. We are seeing imagery, and Israeli media and Israeli officials are doing this as well. They are the ones who are primarily promoting this idea that Iran's capabilities and the damage that its missiles have struck upon Israel is far-reaching and devastating. We see buildings blown out. We see large areas of Tel Aviv completely destroyed by these ballistic missiles that have been launched from Iran. And you even have some Israelis claiming that Iran is turning them into Gaza. So the level of fear, the level of panic that we see the United, we see Israel, and of course the United States behind it, showing that we see Israel and the United States demonstrating, is an indication that Iran's attacks are not only effective, but really putting both Israel and the United States into a corner. So right now, what Israel is doing is it is resorting to very age-old tactics, and its whole operation is based on regime change. So as Iran is trying to establish deterrence, escalation, and deterrence superiority over Israel by hitting hard, mainly military targets, and of course, areas surrounding these military targets. Israel, overnight, and of course, over the last 24 hours, has engaged in sabotage, has engaged in terror tactics, car bombs exploding, targeting Iranian police and security forces, that are searching for the spies and the agents that are really wreaking havoc inside of Iran. This has actually been one of the big strengths that Israel has. It's these covert operations that likely led to Israel's ability to conduct the first attack of surprise against Iran. We see that Iran has stepped up its search of Mossad agents and others that are all throughout the country working with Israel to try to conduct these sabotage operations. And of course, the biggest one, which is now stated in the Western media, in Israeli media, is that they have a plot with U.S. assistance, or mind you, to assassinate the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. So not only this, but Israel is claiming air superiority over Iran. Of course, in some respects, Israel does and has been using its capabilities to strike civilian targets in Iran. We see buildings get targeted over and over and over again. We know that many children have died. Iran is saying that 224 Iranians thus far have been killed, and that in some of these strikes of residential buildings, upwards of 20 to 30 people alone are being killed in a single strike. Israel is becoming more desperate on the military front because they've, in the surprise attack, what was supposed to happen was that Israel was supposed to have hit not only all of Iran's nuclear facilities, but they were also supposed to have destroyed much of Iran's military capabilities, and all of that has failed. While there's been some damage to some of the nuclear facilities, Fordo and some of the most important ones remain intact. And of course, we see that Iran's military capabilities, its missile systems, are deeply embedded in the mountains of Iran underground, and that they are not able to be reached by Israeli munitions. And all indications are that if Israel has any hope of reaching these missile and munition stockpiles, they are going to have the United States come in and essentially drop Moab bunker busters, which are the most powerful weapon that the United States has at its disposal that's non-nuclear. And that will be the only option that Israel has at this moment. Now, the United States has not agreed yet to enter the war in that capacity. It has not agreed that it will have its aircraft and its air force be subject to that kind of escalation, which potentially runs the risk of having an Iranian hypersonic missile and or air defense systems be launched and hit U.S. naval destroyers, sink them, or hit U.S. aircraft. So this is the predicament that Israel is in right now. And I want to address something, because there is a lot of doomerism out there. There's a lot of speculation on Iranian weakness. There's a lot of criticism happening, not only on social media, but of course, in the decades of Israel's essentially carte blanche and impunity that it has had in this region with the U.S.'s help. There's a lot of doubts about what is going to happen here and a lot of fears of Iranian regime change. And I want to address this because as Haifa burns, as Tel Aviv burns, there's a lot of catharsis in these missile attacks. And I want to just say that, one, these missile attacks have shown that Iran has the capabilities to defend itself incredibly effectively, that its missile technology and the amount of missiles, which is still hard to verify, some are saying upwards of 150,000, some are saying 20,000, some are saying somewhere in between that, but regardless, this number is huge, and Iran has just gotten started. So while all of this is impressive, many are fearing that Iran is not able to establish deterrence and will not be able to establish deterrence, leading to a long war which Israel and the United States will use to try to degrade Iranian leadership and the Iranian government to the point where it falls by conducting these horrible attacks on civilians and these terror attacks. And I just want to say this. We have seen, of course, much tragedy in this region, especially in the last year plus, 20 months. Genocide in Gaza, the genocide in Lebanon, let's call it for what it was. Israel wreaked havoc on the Lebanese people as Hezbollah was fighting in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The fall of Syria was also another one of these tragedies, which Israel, of course, had a huge role in helping to happen. So a lot of tragedy in this region. But I want to just say that we have seen that Iran is not any of these situations, much different, in fact, that Iran has shown that its leadership cannot just be decapitated, that its stockpiles and its capabilities militarily cannot just be swiftly taken out. And this poses a huge problem for the United States and Israel itself. And what do I mean by this? Well, the huge problem that it poses to the United States and Israel itself is this very scenario of a long war. The United States and Israel thrive off of quick and swift attacks that degrade the capabilities of the Iranian state and military to the point where it can no longer fight and it needs to capitulate, and it strengthens the proxy forces. In Afghanistan, and in each instance, the United States ended up actually in quite a quagmire, and it was unable to achieve its overall objectives. And we saw in 2020 what that resulted in. That resulted in the United States had to leave Afghanistan. They were ran out. And of course, while they weren't ran out fully from Iraq, their overall objectives failed there. And this is only two cases where the United States' approach failed. Some will say it worked in Syria. And we can say that this is true. But Iran is not Syria. Iran has been going through starvation sanctions for quite some time, but it has never been hit militarily like Syria was over the course of that dirty war. And we know that Israel had already struck Syria hundreds of times over the course of a decade plus. And we know that the United States was engaged in full-scale war under the banner of supposedly fighting ISIS, but actually it was all about regime change. A lot of Syrian infrastructure was destroyed because of this conflict, and a third of the country was able to be occupied. That never happened to Iran. So Iran is indeed in a more stable situation than any of these instances. And of course, we can't really compare Iran to the resistance forces, which face, while very valiant, right, Hezbollah, the Palestinian resistance, Hezbollah's huge capabilities are part of the Lebanese state. They also have a lot of disadvantages geographically, as well as the fact that Hezbollah, because of that geographic disadvantage, had to weigh and consider their role in this fight versus the civilian casualty situation that Israel was able to enact on them. While Israel is hitting civilians and causing psychological harm to the Iranian people at this point, the Iranian people and the Iranian state has obviously been preparing for this for decades, and all reports and indications are that this war that Israel has ignited is actually a huge miscalculation in the sense that it's galvanizing Iranian people around the state, and that if a larger war is to break out, you will have the full extent of the Iranian people, the full power of the Iranian people behind Iran's response. So the situation is different. I don't think it's as favorable for Israel or the United States as the other instances where it has caused such severe harm. And then we have to also understand that the chaos that the United States and Israel have caused in this region has not led to full spectrum dominance. Despite the genocide, despite the ceasefire in Lebanon, despite the fall of Syria, despite all of these tragedies, the United States and Israel are in a more precarious position and were compelled to engage in a desperate war against Iran. So while we can't predict, there's no crystal ball here that says, okay, well, the Iranian government is completely safe, regime change is not going to be carried out. We cannot say this for a fact, but given the situation now where Iran has launched these devastating attacks on Israel, has caused devastation to the psyche of the Israeli regime and U.S. exceptionalism itself, now that it has the capabilities to defend itself and is saying, and we can only garner from this what we might, we can only conclude and make our own judgments on this, but Iran is saying that it has not even gotten started and that its newest missiles and newest weapons have not been utilized. Well, all of this indicates that Iran is not in the precarious position that maybe some believe it is, even if the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is assassinated. Does this achieve any worthwhile objective? Does it lead to regime change? I would say no. I would say actually that would cause Iran to escalate to an even greater degree and create a scenario that the United States cannot handle.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, June 18th. Here are some headlines. Israel and Iran traded fresh strikes early today as the conflict enters its sixth day. Israel said it attacked an Iranian centrifuge production site and weapons manufacturing sites overnight. And sirens sounded across Tel Aviv early this morning as the Iron Dome defense system intercepted missiles that were fired at Israel. Meanwhile, President Trump has yet to say whether he has made a decision on U.S. military intervention in the conflict. Speaking today to reporters, the president refused to say explicitly whether he would order U.S. forces to attack Iran's nuclear sites. Quote, I may do it, I may not do it. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. Close quote. And in a Senate hearing today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told lawmakers that the Pentagon was providing possible options to President Trump, but would not say whether the military was planning to assist with Israeli strikes. This comes as some members of Congress from both parties argue this is not a decision that should be up to the president. Republican Representative Thomas Massey and Democrat Ro Khanna introduced a war powers resolution yesterday that requires congressional approval if Trump wants to commit armed forces to military action in the region. In other news, in a major ruling, the Supreme Court today upheld a Tennessee law banning gender-affirming care for transgender youth. In a 6-3 ruling, the court said Tennessee can continue to prohibit minors from using hormones, puberty blockers, and surgery for gender transition. The court's six conservative justices upheld the ban, and the three liberals dissented. The ruling is a major setback for transgender Americans who have increasingly become targets of conservative states and the Trump administration. The doctor and three families who sued to challenge the Tennessee law said it discriminated based on both sex and transgender status in violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. And as America gears up for Juneteenth tomorrow, amidst a national backlash to diversity, organizers are struggling to match previous year's levels of sponsorship and engagement. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Juneteenth, a federal holiday, commemorates the day in 1865 that the Union Army informed a group of enslaved people in Texas that the war was over and that they were free. The Emancipation Proclamation was signed over 2 years earlier, but this group in Texas did not learn about their freedom until June 19, 1865. Many companies are pulling their support of Juneteenth events, either out of fear of the administration or out of a belief that sponsoring these events may no longer be profitable. Latasha Levy, a professor of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, spoke on this point, saying that this, quote, shows that many institutions and corporations were never truly committed to diversity and inclusion, end quote. President Trump's slashing of the federal budget, including the National Endowment of the Arts, also affects the holiday's funding, although millions are still expected to celebrate the genesis of black freedom. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.